The following are the author's notes.
Not everyone is interested in where short stories come from, and that is perfectly proper. You don't have to understand the internal combustion engine to drive a car, and you don't need to know the circumstances which surrounded the making of a story to get a bit of pleasure from it. Engines interest mechanics. The creation of stories interests academics, fans, and snoops. The first and the last are almost synonymous, but never mind. I've included a few notes here on a few of the stories, such things as I thought might interest the casual reader, but if you're even more casual than that, I assure you that you can close the book without a qualm. You won't be missing much. The Mist. This was written in the summer of 1976 for an anthology of new stories being put together by my agent, Kirby McCauley. McCauley had created another book of this sort called Frights, 2 or 3 years previous. That book was a paperback. This one was to be a hardcover and much more ambitious in scope. It was called Dark Forces. Kirby wanted a story from me, and he pursued that story with doggedness, determination, and a kind of gentle diplomacy that is, I think, the hallmark of a really good agent. I couldn't think of a thing. The harder I thought, the more easily nothing came. I began to think that maybe the short story machine in my head was temporarily or permanently broken. Then came the storm, which was much as described in this story. At the height of it, there was indeed a waterspout on Long Lake in Bridgeton, where we were living at the time, and I did insist that my family come downstairs with me for a while, although my wife's name is Tabitha. Stephanie is her sister's name. The trip to the market the next day was also much as described in the story, although I was spared the company of such an odious creature as Norton. In the real world, the people living in Norton's summer cottage were a very pleasant doctor, Ralph Drews, and his wife. In the market, my muse suddenly shat on my head. This happened, as it always does, suddenly, with no warning. I was halfway down the middle aisle looking for hot dog buns when I imagined a big prehistoric bird flapping its way toward the meat counter at the back, knocking over cans of pineapple chunks and bottles of tomato sauce. By the time my son Joe and I were in the checkout lane, I was amusing myself with a story about all these people trapped in a supermarket surrounded by prehistoric animals. I thought it was wildly funny. What the Alamo would have been like if directed by Bert I. Gordon. I wrote half the story that night and the rest the following week. It got a little long, but Kirby thought it was good, and it went into the book. I never liked it that much until the rewrite. I particularly didn't like David Drayton sleeping with Amanda and then never finding out what happened to his wife. That seemed cowardly to me. But in the rewrite, I discovered a rhythm of language that I liked. And keeping that rhythm in mind, I was able to peel the story down to its basics more successfully than with some of my other long stories. Apt Pupil in Different Seasons is a particularly good example of this disease I have. Literary elephantiasis. The real key to this rhythm lay in the deliberate use of the story's first line, "This is what happened," which I simply stole from Douglas Fairbairn's brilliant novel, Shoot. The line is, for me, the essence of all story, a kind of Zen incantation. I must tell you that I also like the metaphor implied in David Drayton's discovery of his own limitations. And I like the story's cheery cheesiness. You're supposed to see this one in black and white, with your arm around your girl's shoulders or your guy's, and a big speaker stuck in the window. You make up the second feature. Here There Be Tigers. My first grade teacher in Stratford, Connecticut, was Mrs. Van Buren. She was pretty scary. I guess if a tiger had come along and eaten her up, I could have gotten behind that. You know how kids are. The Monkey. I was in New York City on business about 4 years ago. I was walking back to my hotel after visiting my people at New American Library when I saw a guy selling wind-up monkeys on the street. There was a platoon of them standing on a gray blanket he'd spread on the sidewalk at the corner of 5th and 44th, all bending and grinning and clapping their cymbals. They looked really scary to me, and I spent the rest of my walk back to the hotel wondering why. I decided it was because they reminded me of the lady with the shears, the one who cuts everyone's thread one day. So, keeping that idea in mind, I wrote the story, mostly longhand, in a hotel room. Mrs. Todd's Shortcut. My wife is the real Mrs. Todd. The woman really is mad for a shortcut, and much of the one in the story actually exists. She found it, too. and Tabby really does seem to be getting younger sometimes. Although I hope I am not like Worth Todd, I try not to be. I like this story a lot, it tickles me. And the old guy's voice is soothing. Every now and then you write something that brings back the old days, when everything you wrote seemed fresh and full of invention. Mrs. Todd felt that way to me when I was writing it. One final note on it, three women's magazines turned it down. Two, because of that line about how a woman will pee down her own leg if she doesn't squat. They apparently felt that either women don't pee, or don't want to be reminded of the fact. The third magazine to reject it, Cosmopolitan, did so because they felt the main character was too old to interest their target audience. No comment. Except to add that Redbook finally took it, God bless them. The Jaunt, this was originally for Omni, which quite rightly rejected it because the science is so wonky. It was Ben Bova's idea to have the colonists in the story mining for water, and I have incorporated that in this version. The Raft. I wrote this story in the year 1968 as The Float. In late 1969, I sold it to Atom Magazine, which, like most of the girly magazines, paid not on acceptance, but only on publication. The amount promised was $250. In the spring of 1970, while creeping home in my white Ford station wagon from the University Motor Inn at 12:30 in the morning, I ran over a number of traffic cones, which were guarding a crosswalk that had been painted that day. The paint had dried, but no one had bothered to take the cones in when it got dark. One of them bounced up and knocked my muffler loose from the rotted remains of my tailpipe. I was immediately suffused with a sort of towering, righteous rage which only drunk undergraduates can feel. I decided to circle the town of Orono, picking up traffic cones. I would leave them all in front of the police station the next morning with a note saying that I had saved numerous mufflers and exhaust systems from extinction and ought to get a medal. I got about 150 before blue lights started to swirl around in the rearview mirror. I will never forget the Orono cop turning to me after a long, long look into the back of my station wagon and asking, "Son, are those traffic cones yours?" The cones were confiscated, and so was I. That night I was a guest of the town of Orono, that crossword puzzle favorite. A month or so later I was brought to trial in Bangor District Court on a charge of petty larceny. I was my own attorney, and did indeed have a fool for a client. I was fined $250, which I, of course, did not have. I was given 7 days to come up with it, or do 30 more days as a guest of Penobscot County. I probably could have borrowed it from my mother, but the circumstances were not easy to understand, unless you had a skinful of booze, that was. Although one is now not supposed to ever use a deus ex machina in his or her fiction, because these gods from the machine are not believable, I noticed that they arrive all the time in real life. Mine came 3 days after the judge levied my fine and arrived in the form of a check from Atom Magazine for $250. It was for my story, The Float. It was like having someone send you a real get-out-of-jail-free card. I cashed the check immediately and paid my fine. I determined to go straight and give all traffic cones a wide berth thereafter. Straight I have not exactly gone, but believe me when I tell you I'm quits with the cones. But here's the thing. Atom paid only on publication, damn it, and since I got the money, the story must have come out. But no copy was ever sent to me, and I never saw one on the stands. Although I checked regularly, I would simply push my way in between the dirty old men, checking out such literary pinnacles as Boobs and Buns and Spanking Lesbians, and thumb through every magazine the Knight Publishing Company put out. I never saw that story in any of them. Somewhere along the way, I lost the original manuscript, too. I got to thinking about the story again in 1981, some 13 years later. I was in Pittsburgh, where the final Creepshow editing was going on, and I was bored. So I decided to have a go at recreating that story, and the result was The Raft. It is the same as the original in terms of event, but I believe it is far more gruesome in its specifics. Anyway, if anyone out there has ever seen The Float, or even if someone has a copy, could you send me a Xerox copy or something? Even a postcard confirming the fact that I'm not crazy? It would have been an Atom, or Atom Quarterly, or most likely Atom Bedside Reader. Not much of a name, I know, but in those days I only had 2 pairs of pants and 3 pairs of underwear, and beggars can't be choosers, and it was a lot better than spanking lesbians, let me tell you. I'd just like to make sure it was published someplace other than the dead zone. Survivor type. I got to thinking about cannibalism one day, because that's the sort of thing guys like me sometimes think about, and my muse once more evacuated its magic bowels on my head. I know how gross that sounds, but it's the best metaphor I know, inelegant or not, and believe me when I tell you I'd give that little fornit Ex-Lax if he wanted it. Anyway, I started to wonder if a person could eat himself, and if so, how much he could eat before the inevitable happened. This idea was so utterly and perfectly revolting that I was too overawed with delight to do more than think about it for days. I was reluctant to write it down, because I thought I could only fuck it up. Finally, when my wife asked me what I was laughing at one day when we were eating hamburgers on the back deck, I decided I ought to at least take it for a test drive. We were living in Bridgeton at the time, and I spent an hour or so talking with Ralph Drews, the retired doctor next door. Although he looked doubtful at first, the year before, in pursuit of another story, I had asked him if he thought it was possible for a man to swallow a cat, he finally agreed that a guy could subsist on himself for quite a while. Like everything else, which is material, he pointed out, the human body is just stored energy. Ah, I asked him, but what about the repeated shock of the amputations? The answer he gave me is, with very few changes, the first paragraph of the story. I guess Faulkner never would have written anything like this, huh? Oh, well. Uncle Otto's truck. The truck is real, and so is the house. I made up the story that goes around him one day in my head on a long drive to pass the time. I liked it, and so I took a few days to write it down. The Reach. Tabby's youngest brother, Tommy, used to be in the Coast Guard. He was stationed down east in the Jonesport-Beals area of the long and knotty Maine coast, where the guard's main chores are changing the batteries in the big buoys and saving idiot drug smugglers who get lost in the fog or run on the rocks. There are lots of islands out there and lots of tightly knit island communities. He told me of a real-life counterpart of Stella Flanders who lived and died on her island. Was it Pig Island? Cow Island? I can't remember. Some animal, anyway. I could hardly believe it. She didn't ever want to come across to the mainland, I asked. No, she said she didn't want to cross the reach until she died, Tommy said. The term reach was unfamiliar to me, and Tommy explained it. He also told me the lobstermen's joke about how it's a mighty long reach between Jonesport and London, and I put it in the story. It was originally published in Yankee as Do the Dead Sing, a nice enough title, but after some thought I have gone back to the original title here. Well, that's it. I don't know about you, but every time I come to the end, it's like waking up. It's a little sad to lose the dream, but everything all around, the real stuff, looks damn good just the same. Thanks for coming along with me. I enjoyed it. I always do. I hope you arrived safe and that you'll come again. Because, as that funny butler says in that odd New York club, there are always more tales. Stephen King, Bangor, Maine.